How mataka yepe. Hello, my relatives. I am Shumani to Bluebird from Bands of Turtle Island. This is like a cross upload to the Red Nation as well. As well as, I think, People's History Podcast is going to be uploading this. So thank you all for tuning in to, I think it's an important topic. I think a lot of the indigenous communities feel that way. And I think that anybody else who's tuning in is going to feel that way after learning more about, ICWA, which is ICWA, stands for Indian Child Welfare Act. And more importantly, who NARF, or the Native American Rights Foundation, is. So today we have, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. It's Native American Rights Fund and not Foundation.
Fine. Sorry.
That's fine.
So Dan Leverance is here with us today. And, could you, for, the audience, explain like your role at NARF and then how you got involved even?
Sure, happy to. Again, my name is Dan Leverance. I'm a member of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska. And I've been a staff attorney here at the Native American Rights Fund, or NARF, for about 4.5 years. I came to NARF from the U.S. Department of the Interior, where I had helped the United States government defend against some of the early federal ICWA litigation that was filed in 2015, and where I also helped on the legal analysis for the final rule, the regulations that the Department of the Interior promulgated in 2016 to help better implement ICWA. And the Indian Child Welfare Act has been of interest to me for a long time. When I was in law school, I wrote a substantial article with a colleague on an aspect of the Indian Child Welfare Act. So it's been near and dear to my heart for quite some time. At the Native American Rights Fund, I work on a variety of things, but the Indian Child Welfare Act is one of them. And with my colleague, Aaron Doherty Lynch, who works in our Alaska office, we work with various partners on ICWA litigation, helping to defend the Indian Child Welfare Act, and work with a variety of stakeholders on ICWA implementation, how ICWA can be made more effective for tribes and for Native families, and how to build support among other stakeholders, including state child welfare agencies, so that we're all able to achieve better outcomes for Indian children.
And so NARF began in the 70s, right? Is that correct?
Right. The Native American Rights Fund was founded in 1970. We had hoped to celebrate our 50th anniversary back in the spring of 2020 before, I'm sure you all can imagine what got in the way of that celebration. Hopefully we will get together later this year to celebrate our 52nd anniversary. But it was founded as sort of a national clearinghouse for the advancement and the advocacy of Indian law and of Native rights. We act in some ways as a civil rights organization with Native clients. And so a lot of the work that we do, for example, is voting rights work that is very similar to the work that, say, the ACLU or NAACP Legal Defense does, but with tribes or Native people as the clients for that work. And we also do a lot of work that is specialized to our tribes and Native clients, treaty rights litigation, for example. And our Indian Child Welfare Act work falls into that second bucket, where there is this special statute concerning child welfare cases that involve Indian children, and Indian is the term that the statute uses and a lot of the federal statutes use. And so, like I said, we work very closely with other Native organizations who are in this space, whether it is narrowly focused organizations like the National Indian Child Welfare Association, whose real focus just is Indian child welfare, but also more broad-based organizations like the Association on American Indian Affairs, which was instrumental in getting ICWA enacted back in the 1970s, and the National Congress of American Indians, which is a big sort of umbrella organization advancing all sorts of issues on behalf of Indian country. We serve as the kind of the legal voice for those organizations in helping to protect and improve the Indian Child Welfare Act.
How would like a person look deeper into what you all do? Obviously, your website is an excellent resource, but is there any good books?
I think our website probably is the best source, and that is www.narf.org. As far as I know, there isn't anyone who's put together a book or a documentary or some sort of collection of NARF's history. That said, there, if you read about just about anything that's happening in Indian law toward the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, you will see NARF throughout that work. Menominee tribe being the first terminated tribe to be restored to federal recognition, NARF was there. When it was the lawsuits in Maine and the settlement that helped get federal recognition for those tribes up there, NARF was there. And even more recently, in the past 20 years or so, the Tribal Supreme Court Project has been at the forefront of strategic advocacy on cases that have reached the U.S. Supreme Court. And NARF is one of the founding partners and does most of the organizing within the Tribal Supreme Court Project. So NARF has a broad portfolio throughout Indian country, and where you see good being done, you will probably see NARF attorneys there.
And so there's a couple landmark cases, I'd say, that contemporarily speaking have really shown the inadequacies of ICWA today, right? One of those is a recent move in Texas, I believe, is the state. I'm assuming you've been working down there. I know I've read about it through CODA People's Law Project. Mm-hmm. I think that's how it goes. But I was just wondering if you worked with them at all regarding this case, well, these kinds of cases with ICWA, and then as well as adoptive couple versus baby girl is another.
Sure. The Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted in 1978, and for most of its early years, all the way up through probably 2015, the Indian Child Welfare Act was litigation on the Indian Child Welfare Act was carried out almost exclusively in the state courts. And that's because that's where most Indian Child Welfare Act cases are. The Indian Child Welfare Act creates minimum federal standards for child welfare cases involving Indian children in the state courts. And so from the beginning, there have been people who have challenged the Indian Child Welfare Act on one reason or another. They said that it was an improper federal intrusion into states' activities because child welfare cases are in state courts. They said it was an equal protection violation to have a law that was specific to Indian children and not to all children. But all of that played out in the state courts. Now, the first time the United States Supreme Court heard an Indian Child Welfare Act case, that was 1989. And the case was the Mississippi Band of Choctaw versus Holyfield. This was a case that had came out of the state courts, out of the Mississippi state courts, and involved a Mississippi Choctaw parents who mother and father, they were not married. In fact, I think they were both married to other people. And when the mother gave birth, they wanted to have the children removed from the community, and I don't know the specific reasons, but they specifically chose to give birth away from the reservation, even though they both lived on the Mississippi Choctaw Reservation. and to have the child or the children adopted out to a non-Indian family, the tribe then intervened and said that adoption was not proper under the Indian Child Welfare Act, and that should have come through our courts. The Mississippi state courts had said that it was proper in the Mississippi courts and that there was nothing wrong with the adoption. But the U.S. Supreme Court reversed. It said that the parents, because they lived on the Choctaw Reservation, the legal term for this is domicile. They were domiciled on the Choctaw Reservation. That the children, even though the birth was off reservation, their domicile was the reservation also. And ICWA specifically says that when a child, an Indian child, is domiciled on the reservation, the tribal courts have exclusive jurisdiction. So that adoption never should have gone through the state courts. It should have gone through the tribal courts. Mississippi had tried to argue that their statewide definition of domicile was different, and that the children, because they had never lived on the reservation, were not domiciled there. And the Supreme Court made a very important point, which was that although ICWA was written so that it would move mostly through state courts, it was not Congress's intent that there be 50 different rules in 50 different states. Something like what constitutes domicile needed to have a national standard. And so the court adopted a national standard and said the children were domiciled on that reservation. And for many, many years, again, there's very little Indian Child Welfare Act presence in the federal courts. You had mentioned the adoptive couple versus baby girl case, and that was the second U.S. Supreme Court case involving the Indian Child Welfare Act. It also came out of the state courts of South Carolina, which had held that the child had not been properly removed and should be placed with her birth father. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed that, and their decision was that the birth father was not a parent under the act because he had given up his parental rights. Now, there's a very difficult factual history here. There's some real question as to whether he actually gave up his parental rights. And of course, we strongly disagree with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision. But the Supreme Court decided that case and created a standard for evaluating when someone has given up their parental rights consistent with the Indian Child Welfare Act. In some ways, the more important thing that came out of the adoptive couple decision was not the actual decision itself, but some of the rhetoric that Justice Alito used in writing the court's majority opinion and that Justice Thomas used in a concurring opinion. Justice Alito's opinion for the majority in adoptive couple begins by identifying the girl by her blood quantum. He says this is a case about a girl who is 3/256 Indian, or less than 1% Indian by blood, is the way he reckoned it. Now, it's true that that was the blood quantum of the child, but there's another way of saying that, and that is, this is a child whose family has had a political connection, a bilateral political connection between the tribe and the family, going back at least 7 generations. Now, they're saying the same thing, but one puts it in a context that strengthens the relationship between the child and the tribe, and the other puts it in a context that we as Americans are taught to be skeptical of because it looks like it's racial. And that's what Justice Alito was trying to do, was to make ICWA look like a racial statute. And there was other language in his opinion that said some people have made these racial arguments in this case, and the court doesn't need to reach them. We can decide them without getting to these difficult constitutional issues. But if ICWA was to operate on a racial basis, then he was signaling that the court might want to hear such a challenge and might consider limiting or striking down the Indian Child Welfare Act on that basis. Now, Justice Thomas wrote a concurring opinion, so he was agreeing with the outcome of the majority, but for slightly different reasons. And Justice Thomas has long been more skeptical just generally of federal power in Indian affairs, and so he expressed some of his concerns there. The reason I say that those things, which were not the law of the decision, were so important, is that it was after that opinion, those opinions were released, that we saw this new wave of federal litigation challenging the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act. First, there was a case in the federal courts in Virginia brought by the National Council for Adoption and some other plaintiffs. But again, primarily, this was a case advanced by the adoption industry, the people whose business it is to facilitate adoptions, trying to make it easier to get access to Indian children. The second case filed shortly thereafter in Arizona by a nonprofit organization called the Goldwater Institute that has never really cared about Indian affairs before that lawsuit. They mostly tried to challenge federal regulations and increase access to decreased governance of federal lands. You know, mostly they're trying to deregulate the West. They filed a lawsuit in the federal courts in Arizona challenging the Indian Child Welfare Act. And what was particularly insidious about their lawsuit is that it purported to be a class action on behalf of Indian children. And you know, if you read their complaint, they act as if they are bringing suit on behalf of Indian children. Now, both of those lawsuits failed for one reason or another, but the other side is kind of honing its arguments along the way. And the big one that you mentioned was filed in 2017 by some potential adoptive parents in Texas who wanted to adopt an Indian child, the Brackeens, and the state of Texas, both of them challenging raising some of these same constitutional issues that we've seen from the beginning, bringing an equal protection challenge, saying that ICWA discriminates on the basis of race, and challenging the way that ICWA operates through state courts and saying that this was an unconstitutional interference with state affairs. Now, a couple of other individual plaintiffs joined that suit later on in a couple of additional states, although those additional states have since dropped out. And that's the case that is such a big deal right now. The first federal court found that the Indian Child Welfare Act was unconstitutional, but strangely issued no order giving any consequence from that. He didn't issue an injunction or anything. He just wrote kind of his opinion. On appeal, a three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed him and said that the Indian Child Welfare Act is constitutional. And then the plaintiffs asked for a review by the entire Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so that's where we got this opinion from 16 different judges. There are a bunch of fragmented opinions within this. It runs more than 300 pages. Ultimately, they found that most of the Indian Child Welfare Act was constitutional. A couple of provisions they found violated that states' rights provision. They commandeered the states. They had the federal government forcing states to do things that it is not allowed to force them to do. And that is the decision that's on appeal right now to the U.S. Supreme Court. Both sides have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to take up this case. All of the briefs are in at that first stage, And now we're just waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to tell us whether it's going to take the case, and if so, if it's going to take specific issues or if it's going to take the whole thing and take this broad look at the Indian Child Welfare Act. Now, I probably covered a ton of ground there, so if you have something you want to follow up on, go ahead and ask.
Yeah, okay, so there's a couple different things. Well, one, you mentioned, you know, determining based on blood quantum, right?
Right.
And that's controversial in a lot of ways. One, for one, like the affidavit system is very common on reservation, well, you know, amongst our nations to bring in, you know, new members of the tribe, but to like get registered as a member of the tribe, right? And so like with ICWA, how much does it protect like children whose, say, parents are enrolled, but they never were technically enrolled, you know?
Yeah, so this is something that Congress actively debated in the several years that it spent putting together the Indian Child Welfare Act. One early suggestion would have been to limit the Indian Child Welfare Act only to tribal members, but there was concern that because most tribes have this kind of mechanical process, you know, you have to put in an application, and sometimes applications are only considered, you know, once or twice a year, and children need to be protected from the minute they're born, that wouldn't work. There was another proposal that would have extended the Indian Child Welfare Act's provisions to cover any child of Indian ancestry, but the thinking was that that was too broad because it didn't take into consideration whether, for example, the child's parents maybe had actively severed their tribal ties, no longer wanted to be tribal members, and it wanted to respect the ability of people not only to affiliate with the tribes that they may affiliate with, but also to separate themselves from those tribes. And the decision ultimately was that it comes down to this sort of two-piece relationship. The Indian Child Welfare Act defines as an Indian tribe those tribes that are federally recognized. And so there's a government-to-government relationship between the United States and the tribe. And it defines Indian as a member of a federally recognized tribe. So there is a bilateral relationship between the person, the member. Some tribes use citizen. The statute uses the word member. My tribe uses the word member. And the tribe itself. And defines Indian child, the operative term, to include two categories. The first category are children who are tribal members. If you're a member of a federally recognized tribe under the age of 18, ICWA applies to your child welfare cases. The second category, which was meant to account for that, the mechanical process of acquiring membership, was if you are both the biological child of a tribal member and eligible for membership, then the Indian Child Welfare Act applies to your child welfare proceedings too. And that way, if you have someone who, for whatever reasons, has severed their ties with their tribe, and a child might be eligible for membership in that tribe, but the parents have made the affirmative decision that that's not what they want, it leaves that parental choice in. But if a child is born to a tribal member and is eligible for membership and they just haven't done the paperwork yet to get that child enrolled, the Indian Child Welfare Act is still going to apply. And blood quantum has nothing to do with it. I mean, some tribes have that as a condition for membership, but the Indian Child Welfare Act itself does not operate at all on blood quantum or specifically on Indian blood. And I'm sure you and your listeners know that there are tribes that have freedmen members, descendants of African-American slaves from those tribes who are full members of the tribes and may not have any Indian ancestry, but as members of the tribes, they are covered by ICWA like anyone else. There are tribes that had processes for incorporating non-Indians. The Constitution for the Kiowa tribe, for example, allows for membership both of people who are one quarter Kiowa Indian, but also people who were one quarter Kiowa captive. I have no idea whether there are any Kiowa captive members. It's probably been 90 years since that constitution was enacted. But to the extent that there are, those people, a child who qualifies for membership in that tribe and who is the biological child of a member is covered by ICWA regardless of whether or not they have that Indian ancestor. It really comes down to the political status of the tribe, its federal recognition, and the political status of the person, their citizenship or membership in that tribe.
And an inquiry provides that there's an obligation to notify a tribe in regards to adoption. And like, what way does that, do they have to notify? Because, like, obviously, it seemed like with the Brockeen v. Holland case, like, it got a little far. Like, when do they have to notify them in this process?
So I'll start with the fact that there are certain kinds of court proceedings that are covered by ICWA. Those are termination of parental rights, foster care placements, pre-adoptive placements, and adoptive placements. There are other things that children may be involved in, say, some sort of juvenile offense or something, or a divorce proceeding where you're deciding child placement. Those are not covered by ICWA. ICWA only covers those four kinds of proceedings: termination of parental rights, foster care placement, pre-adoptive placement, and adoptive placement. Now, those categories might be a little bit broader than they sound, in part because we do have 50 different state systems for child welfare, and Congress has to write one statute that covers them all, and not all of those 50 states use the same language. So a guardianship proceeding might constitute a foster care placement or a pre-adoptive placement for purposes of the Indian Child Welfare Act. But we start with those four kinds of proceedings. And what happens is, if you have one of those kinds of proceedings, and if the entity that is carrying out that proceeding, whether it's a court or a state agency or a private agency, a private company, has reason to know that the child might be an Indian child, that doesn't mean they have to have the complete set of facts. It just means they have to have some reason to know. Then they're required to notify the tribe so that the tribe has the opportunity to participate in the state court proceedings or even to remove the proceeding to the tribal court. One of the reasons that this was so important was that before the Indian Child Welfare Act, a lot of children were being taken away from their families without any notice or participation either to the Indian family or to the Indian tribe. And children were being removed from tribal settings, from reservations even, without any notice to the tribe that that was happening. The Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted to make sure that both Indian parents and Indian tribes had the opportunity to fully participate in the proceedings involving those Indian children. And I'll add one other thing, and that is, I mentioned the four different kinds of proceedings. There is a fifth, and that is emergency proceedings, and the provisions for emergency proceedings are a little bit different because, obviously, if it arises in an emergency, you have to make some allowances for things. But each proceeding, each type of proceeding is considered a separate step. And so let's say that the state notifies a child or the tribe at a foster care proceeding. And then later on, they proceed to a termination of parental rights. That's maybe a year after the foster care proceeding. Well, that is a new proceeding, and the state needs to notify the parents and the tribe again. And let's say that later on, they move on to make an adoptive placement to that child. Again, that's a new proceeding, and they have to notify both the family and the tribe of that new proceeding. So that at each stage, everyone is fully informed about what's going on and whether and how they want to participate. And so, you know, it might be that for one reason or another, a tribe is not able to or chooses not to participate at a foster care placement stage. And since that's supposed to be a temporary arrangement, maybe there's less of an imperative to participate at that stage. But sometime later, when you move on to something more permanent, like termination of parental rights or adoptive placement, the tribe still needs to get notice of what's going on so that they can make that decision again and make that decision relevant specifically to that more permanent proceeding and that more permanent outcome. And the fact that a tribe participated or didn't participate at one stage does not dictate whether they can participate later on. At each stage, the tribe gets to make that decision, and that's why they need to get notice.
And so with as much ground as you have covered, you also briefly mentioned you know, more focused organizations like NICWA, you know, or you and them have, well, you know, NARF and NICWA have also joined a coalition with the National Congress of American Indians. And I'm just wondering, you know, what's the overall goal with this coalition? And then, like, how can people help, you know, that bring an end to the goal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the Protect ICWA campaign is made up of four different organizations: the Association on American Indian Affairs, the National Congress of American Indians, the National Indian Child Welfare Association, and the Native American Rights Fund. And all four of us work in the Indian Child Welfare Act space, but each of us also pursues our own mission within that space. And so in some ways, the Protect ICWA campaign allows us to collaborate on national objectives within the Indian Child Welfare Act space, whether that's defending the Indian Child Welfare Act in litigation when people have challenged the act in these national challenges that we're seeing, or helping to improve Indian Child Welfare Act compliance and implementation through various localized and nationwide programs. Now, each of our organizations, they're all four great organizations, and each of them deserves your support. I encourage your listeners to look up each of them and see which one sort of appeals to you most. And like I said, each of them has slightly different missions, even if we overlap in one way. And so you may have one person out there who really likes the child welfare focus of what the National Indian Child Welfare Association is doing and the training that they do for both tribal and state and even private agencies and organizations. Someone else might look at some of the both ICWA and non-ICWA work that the Association on American Indian Affairs does and want to support their mission. The National Congress of American Indians has a broader scope and a broader mission. And then NARF also works on a sort of a national scale, but specifically in the legal arena. And I think that among those organizations, I think that most of your listeners can probably find something that they want to get behind. And I know all of our organizations could use your support and would appreciate your support.
And so speaking of the broader scope that NARF takes on, you know, what kind of role in like the anti-pipeline movements does NARF take on?
So the Native American Rights Fund represented two tribes in challenging the Keystone XL pipeline, the Rosebud Sioux tribe and the Fort Belknap Indian community, which are Grovant and Assiniboine on the Fort Belknap Reservation in Montana. And as you know, we ultimately, I don't want to say the litigation was successful because the litigation was ongoing when President Biden came into office and reversed the executive action that had allowed that pipeline to proceed. We also have been involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline litigation. We are working on litigation through the straits up in between Lake Superior and Lake Michigan or Lake Huron. I think I'm not on that case.
The Mackinac Straits.
The Mackinac Line Straits, five. Right. And so, you know, one of the things that we do in this space is that we represent tribes, that tribes sometimes have unique claims that arise from their treaties, that arise from their own rights of governance. And so NARF sometimes works alongside other Native parties, whether individual or organizations, but often has the specific goal of representing tribes in this space. We also do a lot of what is called amicus briefing. Now, most lawsuits involve two discrete parties, right? You're in a car wreck, and it's the driver of car A and the driver of car B, and their insurance companies are involved, but it's a pretty narrow dispute most of the time. But some cases involve broader policy issues that make them very relevant to people who aren't the specific parties. And so those affected outsiders do what is called an amicus brief. An amicus is Latin for friend. Technically, it's an amicus curiae or a friend of the court, where they provide some additional argument and perspective that they think the court can use to help resolve the case. And the Native American Rights Fund does a lot of amicus support in not just in the pipeline work, but in other contexts also, where there are broader issues affecting Indian law and affecting lots of tribes that we want to speak out on. One example of that is that the White Earth Nation has challenged a pipeline approval up in Minnesota, in part because construction on that pipeline would require some dewatering that would actually affect resources, and in particular, wild rice, Manuman, on their reservation, even though the dewatering itself is going to take place off reservation. It would have distinct on-reservation effects. And so they sued to challenge the federal action. They sued in their own tribal courts. The state of Minnesota has gone to federal court to try and shut down the tribe's lawsuit. And the Native American Rights Fund joined in that case as an amicus, representing a number of other tribes, both that you know, in the region that have wild rice, but that also are concerned about the broader issues there about activities off reservation that have on reservation effects. Environmental effects, as you know, don't stop at some artificial border drawn on a map. They flow with the water, they flow with the air, they travel across the land. And so sometimes things happening off reservation are going to have on reservation effects. And we want to protect the rights of tribes to regulate those specific off reservation activities that are going to affect on reservation resources.
And with these, you know, with line three and line five, stuff like that, obviously there's a lot of police repression, of course. Is there any, like, help you guys give towards getting, like, activists out of jail? Or
actually, that is one of our limitations. NARF does not do criminal defense work. So I think that over the years, we have probably been involved at one time or another in maybe the free speech aspect of those kinds of cases. But we don't directly represent people who get criminally charged out of a protest or something like that.
All right. And as far as ICWA is concerned, you know, just jumping back there, there's a tree listed on, like, a tree that helps you understand if your case is affected by ICWA. You know, what are some of, like, the general examples of, like, when people, you know, if ICWA is being challenged and it's, you know, at risk, what is at risk for Indian communities?
You know, that tree actually gets us into a very lawyerly exercise. And so I will apologize to your listeners for nerding out for a second here.
I'm into law, so I'm like, they shouldn't have sent me to, like, interview because I want to nerd out.
But one of the things, you know, when you get a decision like this, people are always asking, what does it mean? And from a legal perspective, courts are kind of geographic entities, right? The federal court in, say, the state of Michigan, the federal courts in the state of Michigan generally handle Michigan cases and they decide Michigan disputes. And other Michigan courts are going to look to those decisions, but they're not necessarily bound by them. Now, if you're in a case in Michigan and, you know, the federal court decides it and someone appeals, that goes to a circuit court of appeals. In Michigan, it would go to the Sixth Circuit. And the Sixth Circuit covers three states, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee. Four states is Kentucky, I think, maybe in the Sixth Circuit also. And if the Sixth Circuit decides that case, then that's going to apply in all of the federal courts in those four states, but not in any other state. Again, courts in those other states might look to it for guidance, but they're not bound by it. Only when it is decided by the U.S. Supreme Court are all of the federal and state courts bound by it. And then we also have this distinction between our federal and our state systems. And I'll give you an example of how that plays out in Brackeen. I told you initially that the overwhelming majority of Indian Child Welfare Act cases arise in the state courts. And that's still true, even despite these relatively recent federal court challenges. They mostly come up in the state courts. So as a general rule, state courts are not bound by federal court decisions unless it's a U.S. Supreme Court decision. So we made that tree because the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that certain sections of ICWA were unconstitutional. However, and someone who's not a lawyer, and even a lot of people who are lawyers, might look at that and think, you know, that means that no one can apply those provisions of the statute. Well, that's not what it means, because that decision only applies to federal courts within that circuit, within the state of Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana. And because most Indian Child Welfare Act cases are not in federal courts, know, they're in state courts. It doesn't even apply to most Indian Child Welfare Act cases in those states, because most of the cases are going to come through the state courts. There were a couple of the judges on that decision who wrote an opinion saying, you know, we shouldn't even be doing this because the federal courts have a rule against making purely advisory decisions. They want to make sure they're resolving an actual case or conflict. And they issued a decision that said, you know, there isn't really a case or conflict here. We shouldn't be deciding this because it doesn't have any practical effect. And that's what that decision tree was supposed to illustrate, was here's how you'd figure out whether that 300 pages of Fifth Circuit decision has a direct effect on your case. Now, even if it doesn't have a direct effect, a judge in your case might look at that Fifth Circuit decision and say, well, I find this persuasive, and so I'm going to follow it. But for the most part, people are not required to follow it. That is one of the reasons that a Supreme Court decision would be such a big deal, is that if the Supreme Court decides it, then everyone does have to follow it.
Lastly, I'd want to ask you, what plans does NARF have for helping with the Red Hill situation and the recent contamination of the aquifer in Hawaii?
I apologize. I'm not familiar with that, so I don't think I'm going to be able to answer that question for you.
Ah, well, that's unfortunate. I was hoping. Yeah, I don't know. It's recent, so I wasn't sure if there was anything going on yet.
But. And there might be. I'll tell you a little bit about our process. The attorneys at NARF, you know, we get far more requests for legal assistance from Indian Country than we have the time and the capacity to take on. And so we have a process when work comes in, when proposed work comes in, for deciding what things we can take on. And that involves kind of getting an understanding of the case and our role in it. Are we representing a party, you know, in a central role in the litigation? Or are we being asked to do some sort of support work, like the amicus briefs I was telling you about? Would we be doing it ourselves, or is there someone else, another law firm or another nonprofit that we would be working in conjunction with? And that also involves looking at all of the things that the NARF attorneys are currently working on and looking to see who has time available on their docket and what that person's expertise and experience are. So, you know, again, I'm not familiar with the particular issue that you raised, but if something were to come into NARF, what we'd be looking to do is number one, do we have anyone who has the time to take on the new work? And that, of course, involves evaluating what kind of work it is and how much time it might take. Is the fit right? Does the person who may have time have the expertise in that area that they would be an effective advocate? Or if they don't have the expertise at the front end, you know, could they get themselves up to speed to become an effective advocate? And unfortunately, we do have to turn away the vast majority of the requests for assistance because we only have so many people and there are only so many hours in the day. But we're still doing a lot of important work and as much as we can do. And I know that most of the NARF attorneys work far more than they're required hours because we all believe in this cause. We aren't just doing it for a paycheck. We're all here because we think this is important work that needs to be done and needs to be done as effectively as possible. And we're always looking for more things to take on, but we don't always have the bandwidth to do it.
And so I guess coming to the end of the interview, is there any other, you know, issues or projects you'd like to spotlight here at the end?
No, I just encourage people to check out the NARF's website and look at our voting rights work. The work we did on the Bears Ears monument and other national monuments, all the work that's being done up in our Alaska office, working with the Bering Sea Elders Group and others. NARF is involved in so many things across Indian country and has represented so many tribes and Native people over the years. I'm proud to be a part of this organization and to be a part of the work that they do. And we appreciate everybody's interest in this work and appreciate your support.
Awesome. Thank you so much.